Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Delighted to have you with us. And then we're going to be back to Following the Money today here on Federal News Radio. And my guest is Arthur Stein. He is a financial planner in the Washington area, knows the thrift savings plan in and out, has a lot of federal clients, customers, I guess is the term. Arthur, I believe I talked to one client of yours, not through you, but he contacted me, and he was a TSP millionaire.
Yeah, and
he did it the hard way.
He did it the hard way. He just invested his whole life, and you know, not surprisingly, if you put in enough money, you will end up being a millionaire.
Right, and particularly during the recession, when so many people, understandably, panicked and pulled out of the stock funds and went into the quote safety of the G fund, and they missed a golden opportunity, huh?
Yeah, and I would disagree with two things in that statement, mm-hmm. Mike.
I only said two.
One is that they understandably panicked.
Okay.
And I understand why they panicked, but it was a bad move, and it's basically not understanding the stock market. And because, you know, as you said in your column, Mike, when things are low, when the stock market is low, it's like buying on sale.
Yeah.
You're buying great American or international companies that produce real things. And, you know, maybe, you know, during the recession, certainly business was bad, but you're getting them at a bargain price. And what has been great historically about the stock market and past performance, no guarantee of future performance, is you did not have to buy and sell at the right time to be successful investing in stocks. All you needed to do was buy and hold on, and not sell when it's down. You know, if people were really great investors, they would sell when the market was high and buy when it was low.
But we're not.
Yeah, but we're not. And Warren Buffett, you know, who's mm-hmm. Actually, he early in his career thought stocks were so high that he closed all his investment funds and just sent the money back to the investors and sold all the stocks. And actually, then the market tanked about 3 or 6 months later. Well, he's like the greatest investor maybe we've mm-hmm. ever had. We're not like that. We tend to get over-enthused when the market is high and buy, buy, buy. And then we panic when it goes down. And I speak to people all the time who sold at the bottom or near the bottom and never went back in, which is, you know, the big problem. And now they're too scared to go back in because the market's so much higher than it was. And actually, I had a new client, a federal retiree, in my office last week. And what he told me was he panicked a couple of years ago, I think it was over sequestration. I think he mm-hmm. said, I thought it was going to tank the economy. I pulled everything out of the C and the S and the I fund, those are the stock funds in the TSP, and put it in the G fund. And he said, you know, before I came in to see you, I sat down and calculated how much that cost me. And he said that was a $50,000 mistake. And of course, he's still not in the C and the S and the I fund because now the market's higher and people are saying it's going to go down. And so then it seems a very scary time to invest.
And it will go down, right?
Absolutely.
And it will go up.
Actually, it always goes down. I mean, the easiest prediction you can make is that the market's headed for a major decline. Mm-hmm. The tough part of the prediction is that saying when that's going to happen.
And how long.
And how long and how deep. But if you're a long-term investor, you don't have to worry about that. You can hold on and wait till the market comes back. And if you look, for instance, at the 10-year returns for the TSP fund, the 10-year returns, and this is through the end of 2014, includes the worst stock market decline since the Great Depression, you know, 2008, 2009, you know, part of 2007. And still, the C fund, if you just bought 10 years ago and held on, you would have averaged 11.9% per year, including these terrible declines. In 2008, the C fund was down 37%. The F fund was only 4% per year. The G fund was only 2% per year. S fund was also 12% a year. Now, the I fund, you know, I will say the I fund did terrible over the 10-year period. It was actually slightly negative to flat. But for a diversified investor, you still would have had a better rate of return in the C and the S and the I funds than if you'd been solely in the F or the G funds.
Well, myself as an example, I have a 401k plan. Not as good as the federal program, by the way, but I don't think many are. But during the recession, I didn't know when it was going to start. I didn't know when it was going to end. I did absolutely nothing. I kept buying at my previous pace, and I'd get those statements and look at them, and it was down, down. The only gain would be the amount of money I had put into it. I mean, otherwise it was a loss, and I felt like a deer kind of in the headlights, but I did nothing wisely. And then one day I got one of those blanks or those forms that showed me what my account was worth, and I thought I had the wrong one. It had seemingly doubled overnight.
Exactly.
And it turns out, and you gave a great example in yesterday's Federal Report, in order to plug you coming on the show and why people should be listening. The headline says food / burgers and stocks for thought. And I, you and I were talking about doing the show, and I said afterward, let's go up to the nearby restaurant. you and I have been there many times. They have now half-price burgers every Wednesday. So after this show, we're going to go have some half-price exotic burgers. But you made this excellent point that on the days when it's half-price, the burger sales spike. Everybody's buying a fancy burger. And yet when stocks go on sale, quotation mark sale, people run away from them.
Yeah, exactly. And an equally disturbing thing about people who panic, and I don't mean to beat up on federal employees, but that's who we're speaking to. And let me tell you, the average investor in the rest of the United States who's not a federal employee is just the same way. Not only did the people I'm speaking about, you know, pull out of the stock funds, but they quit making their investments, their new investments, their biweekly investments into the C and the S and the I fund.
The stock funds, yeah.
And you would think that, you know, and that is just tragic, because then, you know, how much money are you risking when you're putting money in every 2 weeks and you're buying at the lowest, you know, at very low prices? And you can just keep doing that because, you know, with the TSP, whatever your current allocation is, the new money you can allocate it any way you want. It can go into a completely different allocation. So, you know, with some of my clients who are too worried to, like, shift money from G to the stock funds, I tell them, well, you know, at least make your new investments into the stock funds. And that is obviously easier for them to do.
It would seem to me that would be a good compromise for people who they can't sleep at night, so they might transfer money into the Treasury fund, but let your new money, future money, go into stocks. We need to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, but we'll be right back. Hey, Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Glad to have you with us, talking with Arthur Stein about the thrift savings plan and investment programs in particular. Art, you said you wanted to make a correction.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, I just realized that when I did the 10-year average for the TSP funds that I read from the wrong row in the table I have before me. The C fund over the last 10 years averaged 7.7%. The S fund was 9.4%. They both beat the F fund, which was only 5% a year, and the G fund, which was 3% a year. The figures that I gave were for the last 12 months.
Okay, right, good. And you know,
sorry about that.
Right, C is the U.S. stock market.
C is the U.S. stock market, large companies. S is small and medium-sized U.S. companies. And the I fund is international companies.
Right, okay. And then G, of course, is Treasury securities. F is bonds, which very few people, myself included, understand. I got some specific questions for you, but one came in from Grand Forks, North Dakota. and says, question for Arthur Stein's appearance on your show. In August of 2017, I will reach age 56 and be eligible for full retirement. Is there a suggested mix that I should have with my TSP funds at this point? The L2020 Life Cycle Fund seems to have too much in the G fund to me. Are one of the life cycle funds the best choice for someone so close to retirement? And if so, is there one you can suggest? Good question.
Okay. It's an excellent question. And I would say, first of all, as far as the L funds are concerned, you know, they all become what's called the L income fund, which is what people, based on the L philosophy, not my philosophy, I don't agree with this, are supposed to have during retirement. And that is going to be 74% in the G fund, 6% in the F fund, and then the other 20% in the stock fund CS&I.
That seems incredibly conservative.
It's incredibly conservative, and it means that 74% of your investment is going to be losing purchasing power. Every year there's a positive inflation rate, and there's, in the United States, just about always a positive inflation rate. And even the F fund loses purchasing power once you take into account taxes and inflation. So for people who leave their money in the L fund, for L income fund, for long periods of time, they're continually losing purchasing power. And, you know, when they need the money, it may not be worth anywhere near as much as they want. Now, the second part of the question is, I'm going to retire at 56, and, you know, what should my investment mix be? And this is something that, you know, is unique to each person. One, retiring at 56 is very young. You could be retired for 40 years, which, and it would probably be more years than you ever were.
Yeah.
And managing your investments and income over that long a period of time is, you know, extremely difficult, is an understatement. Before I would suggest an asset allocation to somebody, I would want to know, you know, what's your income? What are your expenses? When do you need to start taking withdrawals from your investments? And, you know, let me tell you, if it's 58, yeah, please don't retire, because the thought that you might need withdrawals from your investments for 30 or 40 years, I mean, it's just too soon. And it also means, because he's retiring so early, that he, in my mind, as a financial planner and an investment manager, you need to have a much more aggressive portfolio, because you need to think about the money you're going to need in 10, 20, 30, and 40 years. If you let that sit in the G fund and the F fund, and your purchasing power has been going down over that period of time, you could be in a lot of trouble if you need the money from your investments to live on.
For somebody like me, I like the concept of the L funds, the life cycle funds, because they readjust daily, they rebalance, and they do things that I intuitively would not do if I had the brains to do it. But what about in a case like this, a guy, instead of buying the, instead of staying in the same L fund, and he's going to retire this year at age 56, instead of staying in the going to the present value fund, which is, as you said, is 74%, I think you said 74% in the G fund, the treasury securities, how about going into a 2030 fund if he likes the concept of a life cycle fund?
Yeah, but that's the problem, Mike. If he likes the concept of a life cycle fund, why does he like the concept of a life cycle fund? All the you know, studies that people have done indicate that for long-term investments, things like the G fund and bonds are not the best choice. That historically, stocks have been the best choice because of over long periods of time that they have increased your purchasing power. And that's what you need to do. I mean, retirement is all about having enough income to live on. And part of the income will be from your annuity. Part of it will be from your investments. And what I would say to this gentleman who wrote in, before you retire, see a financial planner, get a retirement plan done, talk to an investment manager, maybe have someone manage the investments for you. Then you won't need to do the L fund, because you'll have someone who's actually matching your need for the money with your investment allocation.
Do you know what the allocation is for, say, the 2040 fund?
At the moment, no.
Okay.
I can tell you that when the funds start, they are 80% in the stock funds, in the C and the S and the I fund, and 20% in the F and the G fund. I don't actually at this point remember what the allocations are. Then they continually become more conservative over time, and they end up 80% in the F and G and only 20% in stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, the a frequent suggestion for retirees is that they really have about 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds for their long-term money.
Well, you know, a suggestion I would make, and this is not intending to be humorous or disrespectful. He's writing us from Grand Forks, North Dakota. Look in your local newspaper, go to the obituary section and read it, and you will be amazed at how many people retired in 1974. And I mean, people who have, as you pointed out, who lived longer in retirement than they spent working.
Yeah, and you know, the average age, the life expectancy for a 65-year-old is about 83. And so a lot of people do their financial planning based on, well, if I live to 83, well, I have enough money.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a good way to do it. You know, if you're the kind of person who you're watching your weight and you get some exercise and you don't smoke and you drink moderately and you don't have some dread disease at the moment,
yeah,
you have an excellent chance of living to 95 or 100.
Yeah.
My dad died at 91. My mom was 89. And, you know, when I reach that age in 20 years from now or 25 or 30 years from now, think how much better medicine is going to be at keeping us alive. I mean, every year they come up with new stuff, new body parts, you know, replacement mm-hmm. parts. I love knowing all these replacement parts are available. And you need to plan for a very long retirement.
Yeah, okay. Back to the column we did, plugging
sure.
your visit here. Some sort of questions you posed for yourself. You said in 2014, the U.S. stock market did well, but international stocks went down. So what? What did you mean by that?
Okay, well, so what might have been a little too flippant.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm thinking is, international stocks have done extremely poorly over the last 10 years. You know, they underperformed the U.S. stock market by quite a bit. And last year, you know, international stocks were down 5%. So we're talking about the I fund and the TSP, I for international. And I'm betting that a lot of people, you know, have quit investing in the international stock index fund. So to me, it's like a good time to buy because the markets haven't been doing well. But also there's another kicker. The U.S. dollar is a lot stronger. So, you know, for every dollar you invest in international stocks, you get slightly more shares because the dollar is stronger. And it's a question of being consistent. You know, you shouldn't just avoid the market because it's down. You should think about, is it a good market? And I happen to think that the stock markets in, you know, Germany and Japan and England and all over Europe and various other places are likely to do well in the future as they have done for long periods in the past.
Well, yeah, and you see these situations where people say, well, look at Greece and look at the Ukraine, the Crimea situation. So I wanted to ask you about that when we take a break. Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Here, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Arthur Stein. He is a Washington area financial planner based in Bethesda, Maryland, but has clients all over the region. And Art, before we get back to the questioning, would you tell us how people can get in touch with you?
Sure, Mike. I'm an investment manager and financial planner. I'm based in Bethesda, Maryland. My office is right about a half a mile from where 270 intersects 495. And my website is arthursteinfinancial.com, ArthurStein, financial.com. I have a blog, various articles on investing and financial planning that I do. And I also send out a monthly newsletter. And so if you'd like to receive the monthly newsletter and notices when I put up a new blog post, you can get on the site, or you can send me an email, art@arthursteinfinancial.com, and I'd be happy to add you to the list.
I get those. I really enjoy them. I get also get one from Alan Roth of CBS MoneyWatch. Very, very interesting, and it makes me realize I don't even know what I don't know, but I'm glad of it. We got a lot of questions here, but I just wanted to tell people your background is fascinating. You taught at university level in Australia.
Yeah.
You advised the government of Botswana on economic matters, and you worked for the Senate?
House Ways and Means
Committee. House Ways and Means Committee. Okay, so very interesting background. So back to the questions here. Here's one. Low interest rates continue to help people borrowing for a house or a car, but hurt savers, the low rate and the G fund. I mean, I guess that's self-explanatory, but...
Yeah, and this has been a political issue in addition for some time. When we had the recession, the Fed rightly felt that lower interest rates were one way to help the economy come back, and the executive branch wasn't pumping up the economy with as much debt spending as was needed. So interest rates have been historically low, really, for years, and they were low before the recession. I'm sure you all see it in your savings accounts, money market funds, you're getting like 0.5% or 1%. So it's a policy that, helped the economy overall, but it hurts individual savers because interest rates are so low. And for people who used to depend on, say, CDs and money market funds to generate income, it's been a disaster because their expenses have been going up, but their income's been going down from the CDs and money market funds. And that's why something like the G fund is not a great long-term investment, because interest rates don't tend to go up over time. They just fluctuate up and down. But prices are always going up. So the purchasing power of interest declines over time. So the money you're getting out of the G fund and the F fund, the interest, it's worth less and less. And of course, the principal doesn't go up in value unless you're reinvesting the interest. So that's going down in value over time too. And it's a difficulty with bond investments over long periods of time and bank accounts as an investment over long periods of time, the loss of purchasing power.
Yeah, and I think you have to take these things, the totality of them. I have a friend who's constantly reminding me that back in the good old days, you could get a Baby Ruth candy bar for 5 cents, but he forgets that he was making $13 a week in those days.
Exactly.
Or you can get into the movie at, I think he said a quarter, but again, he forgets his income. And by the same token, this looking at these interest rates, people say, remember the good old days when CDs were paying 12, 13, some 18%. Well, those days weren't that good.
And they weren't that good. And one of the reasons being inflation was, in double digits too. Taxes were much higher. So it's not even clear at those higher interest rates whether, at that time your purchasing power was going up. Now, if you bought a long-term CD and held on to it, then, maybe you got a good deal. But typically, after you subtract out taxes and inflation, the purchasing power of CDs goes down over time, too.
Okay, the question that keeps coming up, and so many people are interested in it, the pros and the cons of a Roth IRA versus a regular IRA. And would you explain what a Roth is again?
Okay, so we're talking about the Roth TSP compared to the regular TSP. And it's a choice that federal employees have only had for the last 1 or 2 years. And the difference is this. The money you put in the regular TSP is tax deductible the year that it's contributed. And when you take the money out, you pay tax on all the money that you take out. The Roth TSP, the major difference is the money that you contribute, you do not get a tax deduction. Your income, your taxable income remains the same.
Yeah.
But when you take the money out, remember this could be 20, 30, 40 years in the future, there are no tax on the withdrawals. So I like the Roth TSP option. Now remember, the agency match cannot go into the Roth TSP. that has to go into the regular TSP. It's only the employee contribution that go in. But I think it can be a great idea for lots of federal employees, especially younger federal employees, because one, their tax rates tend to be lower because their income is lower, so the deduction's not worth as much. But also the money's going to be in there longer, so it has longer to compound, be worth more when you take it out. So the fact that you're not paying income tax on the withdrawals from the Roth TSP becomes a much bigger deal.
I mean, that's boosts it by 30% depending on the tax bracket, doesn't it? And also for an older employee, maybe not ancient like us, but older employee, you might want to put it into a Roth if you can afford that to leave a larger estate for your kids.
For an older employee, it's somewhat less important, but there's also another advantage that I haven't yet mentioned, which is that there are no what's called required minimum distributions on a Roth IRA, or I assume on the Roth TSP, and therefore, and what the required minimum distribution is, when you hit 70 and a half, you have to start taking money out of the regular TSP and regular IRAs. The minimum amount, it grows over time. With a Roth IRA, there's no required minimum distribution. You can leave the money in. And, you know, like I have clients who have to take money out of their IRAs, even though they don't need the money at the time, so they're forced to pay taxes on it.
Yeah, the government. Now, if you're still working, does that minimum distribution, it does not?
If you were still working, and for the federal government, the money that you have in the TSP is not subject to required minimum distributions. And there are lots of feds who benefit from that. You know, they're working past age 70.
I want to make a very dangerous generalization here between the sexes in investing. If I had to characterize men versus women investors, and you're looking at the people who pull out and do these things, and the guy you were talking about who was figuring all the angles, I would say a lot of men are too bold. They look at, they analyze too much and make assumptions and then act accordingly. And many women, I think, are too conservative in that they're nervous. They, unlike the men, they know what they don't know, but they retreat to something like the G fund. And I had a friend who had a substantial 401k plan from the private sector. She came into government, rolled the money into it, listened to this show, talked to me, and when the recession hit, she said, "I can't sleep at night. I just can't do it." And so she pulled all of her money out of the CS&I funds, the stock index funds, and put it in the G fund and just sat there. And I think now she's at the stage that you say is the critical point is, when do you come back into the market? And I don't think she's come back yet.
It's not only when you come back, but, you know, look at all the money that you lost by not being in the market
and
when it recovered.
Not buying regularly.
So much easier just to leave your money in. Again, you don't have to trade. You don't have to buy and sell at the right time to make money in the stock market. Historically, you just needed to buy and hold. And it makes it a really incredible, unique investment. Because, you know, you just have to be goal-oriented and know that buying, that trading is unlikely to leave you ahead of the game.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes, too, we overanalyze things. And I have been told from people who are from other places, I grew up here, but they're from other places, that the Washington media hypes the weather beyond anything they've ever seen. And I did hear a broadcaster the other day said it was going to be 78, but it was going to feel like 79.
I mean, wow.
That's frightening.
News you can use, right?
but you know, that said, when I hear people say, and of course you hear the regular reports, it's 24/7, but when I hear people say, "I made X amount of money today," or "I lost X amount of money," you really didn't. Nothing happened, correct?
A lot of the press, and there's certainly great people writing about stocks and investing, but a lot of what you're going to read just extrapolates from whatever is going on. So if things are going up, you know, the press gets as excited as everybody else. And when it crashes, then they kind of assume that this is the end of civilization as we know it, and it's never coming back.
Well, a fellow reporter once years ago told me, he said, all of us, meaning for our reporters, are at heart, we're sports writers, and everything is a contest, you know, tossing their hat into the ring,
yeah, right.
Neck and neck. It's a home run, slam dunk, but we think in sports term analogies like that. Okay, so the dangers of being too cautious, the trade-off between risk and reward. We talked about that some, but I don't think you can emphasize that too much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing about stocks is they are much, much more volatile than bonds, although you will see the F fund go up and down in value. And in 2013, the F fund, which is the bond fund, lost money over, you know, that 12-month period. But stocks are much more volatile. They can go through long periods of time where the returns are either negative or close to zero. And people have to be prepared for that. And, you know, some people are not. But there's a real cost to that. You know, I mean,
yeah,
staying
exactly,
out of the stock
exactly.
market with your investments has a cost, and it's the loss of purchasing power because of the other things, the other investments you're in, bank accounts, the G fund, the bond fund, the F fund, things like that. And people don't see that risk, and they don't see that loss of purchasing power.
Great, great last summation. And we're going to be talking with Andy Medici from the Federal Times in a moment. And then you and I are going to go get one of those half-price burgers, yeah. Arthur. Thank you very much. We'll have it again. Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Had a nice chat with Arthur Stein. And a reminder, if you want someone else to hear this or you want to hear the show again, all of our Your Turn shows, as with all our shows on Federal News Radio, are archived on our homepage. So you can listen at leisure, at home, or wherever. We'll be talking with Andy Medici now. This is one of my favorite parts of the show. And Andy, good news, bad news for us here on the station, about our career track for you.
Yeah, I'll be leaving Federal Times in a couple of weeks and going to the Washington Business Journal.
Well, I'm delighted you moving up and onward. Sorry to see you go, but we will stay in touch and get you on the show from time to time. So thank you for all of your past appearances. It's been very educational.
Don't worry, I'll always be listening, Mike.
Very good. Well, you couldn't be here at a better time, more interesting time. What is it? The ancient Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. With this hack, there are the two hacks that we know of so far. The federal government. Who did it? What were they after? And what do you think they can do with this stuff?
Well, see, that the big question that people are asking is who did it and why, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sources within the government have been pointing fingers towards, select agencies within China who've been at the lead of other cyber attacks over the last couple of years. And what they've taken, though, at this point, you know, they say the investigation's ongoing, but as the head of the AFGE union said, it looks like they took everything.
Yeah.
You know, they got personal information. A separate intrusion has gotten into background security check information and has really just anything you can think of. And all the things that they warn you about that data being online, they took it all. Names, possibly social security numbers, dates, places you used to live, people you know. And what they can do with it, though, that I might leave that up to better imaginations than
yeah.
me. But it's definitely a risk for anyone whose information was taken.
Well, and, you know, if they get your name, your address, your date of birth, your social security number, that's a scammer's dream package come true. The background information, I think it hasn't quite sunk in for some people yet, but it is just that. It is background information on you, your character, your sexual proclivities, whether you drink too much. And this is not what you're self-reporting. This is also what people who know you have told the government about you as part of a background investigation. And that's where blackmail for espionage purposes and that sort of speculation comes in.
Well, see, that's the real danger with the hacks of this nature, is that you have maybe more mundane purposes, right? People trying to create fake credit cards in your name, open accounts in your name. And then there's the far more nefarious purposes, which could anything from corporate and you know, sovereign state espionage to blackmail. And so the real worry is really that we don't really know what will happen because of this information. These are very large lapses in security, and we don't really know what the future might bring, but we're worried about the type and amount of information that's out there now.
Well, I got a couple of emails from people, and I know next to nothing about IT, but they said, why wasn't this information encrypted? And my immediately thought was, A, I'm not quite sure what encrypted means, except made safer and harder to crack. But you would assume that information like this would be as sealed as possible, but apparently it was not encrypted, huh?
Well, some of these systems weren't encrypted. You know, the Office of Personnel Management has said that, you know, some of these systems are too old to have been encrypted or to be encrypted very well, while some of the systems were also protected by what, you know, people now know, you know, people call Einstein, the sort of watchdog and perimeter security of federal networks. But theirs was a little out of date, and they only found out about the breach by updating it. So there were some large lapses, and, you know, lawmakers are not happy, and they started to call for resignations and, you know, perhaps even firings as a result of this.
Well, do you think it rises to that level that, I mean, obviously people want heads to roll, but is the director of the OPM, I mean, I know the buck stops at that desk, but is the director the one that should be punished for this?
Well, I guess it all depends on how you feel about where the ultimate responsibility lies. You know, is it the OPM director? Is it the CIO? Is it the CIO of the agency? You know, at the end of the day, we've talked about other scandals over the years, or other, you know, scandals in quotes, and nothing's really risen to the level of this hack, which is essentially that they were entrusted with safeguarding federal employee security, and they failed. So I guess it really depends on what you think the price should be for that failure. Was it institutional and hard to avoid, or is this something that the government has known about and has worked on for years but has never really managed to get quite right?
Well, I want to ask you something, and correct me if I'm wrong here, because, again, I know very little about this, what I read in the papers. This happened apparently in December, they believe. They found out about it in April. I think that's the timeline. And then they told the world on June 6th, which I think is interesting, D-Day. So this information has been out there for a long time. Now, if this was Boris the hacker in Latvia or Ukraine or somewhere, that means the information has been out. You would think that some people would have noticed problems with their credit by now, that, you know, if they sold a list, that you might realize there's a television set charged to your credit card that you didn't order, or something's wrong with your bank statement stopped coming or something. We don't know that that's been happening, so it would seem to be that whoever stole this didn't do it for purposes of messing up your credit.
Well, that's the thing, you know, it's what is the purpose of these people who are taking all this information? What are their end goals? And you're right, you know, we haven't heard a lot of reports about widespread fraud among the federal workforce. But, you know, a lot of the times this data does take time to get into use. You know, it could be sold or brokered. You know, people pay money for identities. You know, it might be merged with other data. So, but ultimately, this is one of the situations where people are worried about the far more nefarious reasons that they might have exposed, you know, civil servants and the large batch of federal employees, current and former, to something that could be far worse than that.
Well, and the government has promised, I believe, credit monitoring for 18 months and some kinds of insurance. The head of the AFGE, David Cox, has said nonsense to this 18 months thing. He said the government should offer them credit monitoring for life. Is that reasonable?
I guess it depends. You know, if you look at those background security checks and how thorough they are, you know, no matter how much you wait or how long you wait, a lot of that information is never really going to go out of date, right? So the idea that you should wait 18 months and hope for the best, you know, he's got a point that this has affected people who've put their trust into OPM to safeguard that information. A lifetime, I don't know, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we started seeing lawsuits come out of this about how much federal employees should be made whole by this situation.
You know, those background checks, too. Back when I was young, just starting out working, I was still in the Army Reserves and all that. And background investigators used to come see me all the time about friends of mine who were getting out of college or getting out of the Army or starting a job. And it got to where there was one Army investigator who would I'd see maybe once a week. He'd just come by, and I asked him, how come we saw each other? He saw me, and he said they had the territory divided up, and I was down at 15th and L Street. So whenever a background check with my name up came up, he got it. And after we sort of established an acquaintanceship, I said, isn't it kind of silly? I tell you who to go ask about my character, and then you go interview him. And I said, it's always going to be good, right? And he said, I've never forgotten, he said, you'd be surprised what your friends say about you. And so in these background checks, there may be some information that's now in the wrong hands that you definitely don't want anybody to know.
Well, and, you know, that's one of those things where you don't really, a lot of people don't really know what's in those files,
sure.
You know, so it's really the lack of that as well that's disconcerting, too, because while we might know what we put into federal employee applications or benefits information or pension information, a lot of that background information is quite deliberately kept from the employees that were interviewed and their friends to have in reserve to make sure that people meet those levels for clearances and top secret clearances. And so I think we're only really just at the beginning of understanding what was taken, and even more so at the beginning of why it was taken and what it might be used for.
Yeah, and someone might unwittingly say, oh, he doesn't drink that much, or I've only seen him falling down blind drunk 3 times this month, that kind of thing, thinking they're getting you off the hook.
Well, exactly. And, you know, there have been other breaches at other agencies over the last couple of years. And a lot of the danger, too, is what you can do if you combine the information that's been taken over the last couple of years. If the same actors were involved in several different breaches, they actually have a much more complete picture of the federal government and the people who work for it, even contractors, former employees, and even people who just applied. So, you know, that picture might be coming together for the people who might have more nefarious
things. Okay. Story's good. Andy Medici, thanks for being with us. We'll stay in touch with you. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a